Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Zane Seyfert. You already knew that. That's why you're here. Actually, the reason you're here is for our guest today. Rod Wagner is our guest today. Rod is one of the foremost authorities on employee engagement and collaboration. His books, speeches, and research focus on how human nature affects business strategy. He currently serves as Vice President of Employee Engagement Strategy at BI Worldwide, and we're here to talk with him about his latest book titled Widgets, The 12 New Rules for Managing Employees as If They're Real People. Now, this book is so good, I want you to stop listening right now, put it on pause, go find the book on Amazon, buy it, read the first 150 words of his introduction, get a feel, a flavor for what he's about to introduce, then come back and finish listening. Rod, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks, Zane.
And thanks for writing such a great book. My goodness. It was just a breath of fresh air when it arrived in the mail a few weeks ago.
So I had a lot of fun writing it.
I could tell. It really engaged me as I was reading it more and more. You can't see me, but I tend to wave my arms and all that. So before I spend the whole show waving on your book, because I will, let's talk about you and this book. Why now? Why this book? Why this title?
Well, yeah, I've been in the so-called employee engagement business for 16 years. Employee engagement is still in my title. But business, the business of employee engagement and the strategies around it really haven't changed. Meanwhile, the world has. I wrote my first book on employee engagement nearly a decade ago, in 2006. Mm-hmm. And it's awfully tough to name something that exists now that is the same as it was in 2006, except for the fact that maybe we put our pants on one leg at a time. Otherwise, everything's changed. Social media, LinkedIn, the recession, how millennials are affecting the workplace, things have changed dramatically. And I call it widgets because there's a current in how people are managed and led by, in many cases, these very large corporations, where they end up feeling like they're just a cog in the wheel, just a number, just a widget.
Especially like the little touch you did by not capitalizing the word widget, just to reinforce how unimportant that person is. Now, the next question is a bit unfair, but hey, so's life. Why have companies grown so fearful of seeing employees as people? I mean, there's a whole separate vocabulary corporate communications people use to avoid acknowledging that very simple truth.
I think there's a whole host of issues, a whole host of causes that have put us where we are today. In many cases, there is no conspiracy. They're not in concert with each other. They just happen to occur at nearly the same time. One of them is the fact that money is really impatient. So publicly held companies, people don't hold the stock of companies very long, and they want their return on the investment now. And they really don't care. They're not in it for the long haul. They really, and therefore, their direction to company boards of directors and to company management is, make me my money now. If that means you have to lay off people, if that means you have to process them and be inhumane, so be it. I want my money. The recession threw things off. And so up until, you remember the war for talent, pre-recession, everyone was falling all over themselves as to what they could do for their employees, and then switched almost manic form into, we got to get rid of people and we got to cut pay and whatever that takes, we don't care. I think we're still living in kind of a hangover from the Great Recession, even though companies now are worried about losing their good people. We have that undercurrent that was set in place by that geologic economic event that occurred in the Great Recession.
Excellent. Very good answer. Thank you. Describe the reader you have in mind. Who should read this book? Who are you writing for?
Well, as the subtitle suggests, the 12 New Rules for Managing Employees as If They're Real People, the primary audience are people who have some responsibility for people. They're either leading an organization or they're frontline managers, to understand what their obligation is to those people. But at the same time, I also wrote it as a benchmark for people who are not supervisors, for them to understand, well, this is what you ought to be getting. You don't have to be shy about it. This is what the research says motivates someone, including yourself. And so this is what you ought to be getting, and this is how you ought to be managed.
Of those three audiences, which one is the most favorable to your book and message? I know it's early.
There's frontline managers, I think, get it fastest because they're nose to nose with real people, 10, 12 real people on a regular basis, so they get it and they're eager for new insights. Leaders of organizations fall into two camps. There are leaders that don't get it and, quite frankly, don't want to get it. They're paid many millions of dollars to run the machinery, to keep it going, to create high levels of shareholder value. There's even research that suggests that at that level of power, they're much less empathetic than other people would be. And then there are other CEOs who do get it, to say, oh, absolutely, of course, this is what I want my legacy to be. I wouldn't want anyone to work at a company that I oversee and have a terrible experience here. Plus, it's the right strategy.
So let's role play a little bit, or let me role play for a little bit. Let's say I'm a frontline manager, and I'm listening to this conversation, and I'm thinking, okay, Rod, like a title, like the subtitle, but, you know, what's in it for me, really? You know, I got a lot on my plate. I am the proverbial rock in the hard place where my office is.
Sure.
So what's in it for me to learn about these 12 new rules?
Well, I'll tell you what's not in it, and that's, here's what you do first and here's what you do second. This is not a workbook. It's not a manual that's going to walk you through here's how to manage your people. Instead, here's the philosophy and the strategy and why people will work really hard for you. Let's get inside their heads and understand why someone would give the levels of loyalty and commitment that you're looking for. At the same time, you know, I want to emphasize that I would hope that what's in it for the reader is a really good read. I had a lot of fun in the writing so that people would enjoy the reading. And I got to tell you, this is a little bit of a rant, but the business category is just awful. I mean, I like reading. I don't like reading business books. I think most of them are terrible. That part of the bookstore, you'll find some of the worst writing. It's peppered with euphemisms and their limp stories, and sometimes what's in it is demonstrably wrong. So I wrote widgets to be read to be enjoyed, as basic as that may seem. And so in the reading, I'm looking to provoke people's thinking. They may not agree with everything in the book, but I guarantee that they'll have a stronger and more informed opinion about their people strategy than if they just clipped along and had the same kind of employee engagement conversations that could have been copied straight out of 1998.
All right, I got to jump in with testimonial here. That's one of the reasons I so liked your book, was because it was fresh, it was engaging, it was direct. It wasn't confrontational, but it was exposing a lot of truth and puncturing a lot of sacred cows in a well-written way. And I completely agree with you about business books in general. I read a lot of them, and only the ones I really like get on the show, and most of them, like you said, are euphemisms, and some of it's not really very accurate as well. So, and your book was so different. It was so refreshing. So, again, I hope people listening will go out and get it. Now, let's go back to this manager. I'm back in my manager role. Why should I believe? I mean, you're articulate. You hired a good designer, but you're a good writer. But why should I believe?
Well, the most important reason to believe is I'm an empirically based writer in all of my books. So the foundation of this book is some really cool research that my colleagues and I at BI Worldwide have been conducting over the last few years on what you might call the psychological contract between employees and the companies where they work. And the research, I feel, to be straight up and very transparent with readers, that you ought to show your work. And so that research is detailed in an appendix that Dr. Brenda Kowski wrote. She was the head of the research that we conducted. The book's it's heavily sourced. It's endnoted throughout. And so if someone wanted to, they could review the same sources that I did in researching and writing the book. It would take a little while, but I love when people are skeptics, when they say, prove it, you know, show your sources. Where'd you get that from? Because I think it creates a richer conversation. I'd much prefer a rich, vigorous debate about these issues that leads to someone disagreeing with my point of view than someone kind of complacently just going along and saying, oh, yeah, employee engagement, boy, that's important, and they work harder, and we're going to do a survey, and we've got it covered kind of thing.
Checklist, checked off, excellent. Regarding your notes, I haven't looked at everyone, but one thought crossed my mind when I was back at the end of your book looking through all the notes. I was thinking that could be my reading list for the next 6 months. On employee engagement, because it is so well footnoted and with sources that I'm not so familiar with. I'm not going to get into the whole names and everything, but it's a great list, and it just broadened my horizon for more resources to read. So thank you for that. Now, you talk about a psychological contract between the employee and their company, and I think that's based on your principle of reciprocity, the reciprocal nature of an engaged relationship. Is that correct?
It's one of the most fundamental reflexes in human nature, that we look out for the people who look out for us, both socially and in the workplace. That if you if you look out for an employee, you individualize, you make them fearless, you compensate them well, you make sure you're not working them 60 hours a week, and they know that you care about them and you're doing all you can to make them have the best employment experience that they can. The vast majority of people will reciprocate that by saying, I really owe it to my boss and to my company. They've been really good to me. I want to be there early for this special meeting that we're having. I want to come up with a really cool idea. I want to make my impact at this organization and help them achieve their goals, as opposed to saying, you know, it's just a job. I put in my 8 hours, I showed up on time, and I left on time, and you got my 8 hours, and I'm not thinking about it until I come back tomorrow.
Yeah. As you're talking, and I'm kind of envisioning that employee who wants to be there early, you know, prepared, already on the conference room, you know, papers spread out, ready to engage. I'm thinking a lot of that internal conversation is almost subconscious. It's just, you know, an easy flow, you know, a natural occurrence when you're rewarded and recognized. It's not an elaborate mental exercise.
That's true, certainly, of some of the aspects of a great job. Money, for example, tends to be a background issue. We don't think about our company, unless you're a commissioned salesperson whose pay is quite variable.
Right.
We tend not to think about our pay every day. You get paid the same amount every 2 weeks, and then there's maybe a bonus or something year end or quarterly or something like that. But we don't go home to our spouses and say, hey, guess what? I got paid this Wednesday the same amount I got paid 2 Wednesdays ago and the same amount 2 Wednesdays ago before that, until it becomes an issue, until a recruiter calls up and says, hey, how'd you like to make $40,000 more a year? Or you find out that the guy that's got hired 3 years after you and who you don't think works very hard or very well is making the same as you are. Now it's an issue, and it's out of the background, and you have to deal with it.
You know, instead of that conversation at home, you're telling them about, you know, I did this or that, or we, you know, had this headache, but we overcame it. You know, I had this great meeting, we solved this problem, I had this initiative.
Yeah, we tend to talk about recognition. We tend to talk about collaboration. we tend to talk about achievement. Most of these are, instead of financial issues, numerical issues, they're people-to-people kind of things. It's a story, because that's how our brains are wired, to talk about, you know, long ago when we were cave people, hey, I went out and was hunting with this guy, and we got a tiger, or a tiger nearly got us, and, you know, here's
right.
what we caught some fish, and here's what we did, right?
Right. We eat again tonight. Awesome. Now, the first step in your 12-step program is get inside their head, and you describe it as the most fundamental of your new rules. And as I read, I thought, yeah, exactly. But then I thought, well, before that, the real challenge is for management and leaders to first get outside of their own heads and offices, and but therein lies the rub, doesn't it? I mean, that's the real friction. Go ahead.
That's an important insight. People are naturally self-centered, and we worry about what we're having for dinner, and I got to go see the doctor about this thing, and my knee hurts a little bit, or, you know, when are the kids getting out of school, all that kind of stuff. That's why managers and leaders get paid more. They are paid to invest themselves in the success of others. I had a fantastic opportunity last week to be aboard and submerged on the U.S. Navy attack submarine USS California, and to interview its captain, Commander Eric Sager. And as he and I were talking, he made an interesting observation. This is a $2.3 billion boat loaded with technology, you know, sonar and torpedoes and all these, you know, nuclear power plants at the back of the boat, all these incredible things that are just jaw-dropping. And yet he said, he's been in the submarine service for 17 years. And he said, when my officers and I sit and talk about the strategy, we don't talk about the boat that much. The boat is technology. It reacts predictably. We talk about the people, because the people's reaction, our you know, crewmen's reaction is not necessarily predictable, and it's crucial to our the execution of our mission to protect the United States. And so we need to be dialed in really well on the people here, and that's more complicated than the $2.3 billion boat.
That's such a great example. It just crystallizes everything with this whole challenge. One of my favorite parts in your book was near the end, and when I was reading it, I was so glad that I did not have a mouthful of coffee. I may have spewed it on my keyboard. Because it was such a surprise when you started writing about the Stuxnet virus, you know, and a brief reminder on that, that's the one someone sent to Iran to infect their nuclear research program, and it made their centrifuges spin wildly out of control, while back at the dashboard everything looked like all is well. And you compared the Stuxnet virus with employee engagement surveys. And I'm still smiling, and I'm still enjoying that comparison. So what are the similarities between those two?
Well, you've described the virus very well. We don't know who sent it. It's one of those, you know, if the people that sent it, if they told us, they'd have to kill us kind of thing. But we know what it did. Yes, it messed things up behind the scenes, but the dashboard said everything was fine. So let's take an example. This happens all the time. Someone joins a company. Let's say he's a good worker. He's prepared to be loyal and dedicated and all that. He joins a company. Well, as happens to a lot of people, maybe he doesn't get the greatest manager in the world. So that manager, he or she, doesn't really invest a lot of time. This employee doesn't get a lot of recognition. And maybe he's afraid because there's a threatened plant closure or something like that. Now the company says, hey, we're going to do a survey, and we want your honest answers. We need you to tell us what's really going on. Yep, tell us the truth.
Yeah.
So he goes in and says, does your manager understand you? Like, no, not really. He doesn't spend much time with me. Does how about recognition? Well, no, I haven't gotten any. I mean, he's just reporting the facts.
Right.
You want to tell you the truth, right?
Yeah, tell the truth.
So then the survey comes out, and in fact, it might turn out, this happens a lot, that manager is getting a bonus based on high engagement scores. So now the survey results come out. In many cases, there's only four or five people who are represented on a single team scorecard, and it's clear that somebody or some one more than one put some low score on the survey. That manager now might decide, you know what, all right, you want to play that way? I'll show you how this goes. And they change that person's job or they retaliate. So
yep.
What did he learn out of this? He learns, as one person said that I found this comment online from an administrative assistant, just said, mark five to survive, baby, mark five to survive. In other words, if the company asks, you are perfectly happy here. And so now you have a... excuse me, you have a Stuxnet in place. The official answer is everything is fine.
Yeah. Going great.
So now your dashboard says everything is fine, but underneath you have an engagement problem. You can't see it now. And that's not what I just described is not a stretch. All those things happen at many organizations that are running traditional employee engagement programs.
No, you hear me laughing. It's just, it's such a contrast between, you know, intents and purposes and execution and realities. And that comparison of the Stuxnet and virus with employee engagement surveys just crystallizes it and explains it so well, while, you know, the fundamental basis is so well fought with peril.
Yeah, I wrote a column for Forbes a week or two ago where I posed the question, you know, have we reached the end of the age of employee engagement? And a lot of people have taken issue saying, no, engagement is still important. Well, yes, engagement, the phenomenon, reciprocity, the idea that you want to manage people well, yes. But for many employees, when they hear employee engagement, they're hearing, hey, you're about to do that process. You're about to mess with me and intimidate me to either give high answers or I give low answers that are honest, and then you come after me because I told the truth.
And all this time, in the back of their minds, they're thinking, well, if you're interested in my opinion, why don't you just come and talk to me? Why do you need a survey between you and me when we spend all day and have spent all day for the past 20 years working together? Why can't you just come and talk to me?
Well, absolutely, and particularly given the fact that most surveys are conducted only once a year. So for 11 and a half months of the year, the company's really not listening methodically. And then for 2 weeks, they say, you know, we need your opinion right now, and it's compulsory.
It's compulsory, and we are so interested. Your opinion is so important to us, we're going to do this annual survey. Yeah.
I don't think there's a lot to be gained from surveys. There's a lot that you can do in the analysis to understand, particularly when you're dealing with answers from the whole company, to understand where the company ought to focus its resources. But those kinds of traditional surveys are next to useless as far, certainly under the current environment, intimidation and concerns about candor and all that, just about useless for the actual day-to-day managing. That's where you just go have coffee with your employee and say, how you doing? What can I do for you? How can I better support you?
Right.
What can I do as your manager to help you?
Right. So simple. And you do it on a regular basis, like every day, every other day. After a while, you have an engagement. You have trust. We're gonna riff on this forever. I can tell right now. And it's, you know, it just comes back to it. It's, for me, employee engagement is a conversation. You know, one that step by step you engage and build trust and a relationship and communication, and the reciprocity comes to play. It always comes to play. All right, let's talk about taking it to extremes. That's your 12th step, and you talk about you know, some extreme athletic events. I'm a marathon shuffler at this point in my life. You know, by the time I finish the, there's one lukewarm beer left on the curb and everybody's gone home. But how do you apply that step, take it to extremes, into a standard business setting? Give us an example of that.
Well, there is. It's interesting in the recreation world that now everything's extreme. It's not just a regular 5K. It's you got to jump through fire, or you get electroshock somewhere along there, whatever. And we live in a culture of accomplishment, personal accomplishment. You get even if you're shuffling through the marathon now. If you finish, you get a finisher medal. That's part of our culture.
That's
and
right.
In the workplace, it means. You have all these goals for your company. We want to double sales in 7 years. We want to take market share. We want to introduce this new product. So you have all these things you want the company to accomplish. What businesses frequently fail to do is look at what are the accomplishments our employees ought to get out of this, particularly given the fact that some of these employees we may not have in 10 years. We might have a reduction in force or whatever. And so we need to be able, those employees expect that, if I'm going to help the company get to a certain place, what is the company going to pin on my chest that I can take to my next job to say, look what I did?
And to take it within the company and show people, here's what I did, here's what our team did, here's what our group did.
It's interesting on the submarine, and this is true of the military across the board. The military has a certain mission, certain things that they want to accomplish. Well, they're one of the best organizations or sets of organizations at making sure that the accomplishments of the individual members of that team are acknowledged, that they get to literally wear them on their chest. Or in the case of a submariner, earn his dolphins. That is a respected symbol for the rest of his career, even if he's not in a submarine, even if he's working in the Pentagon. If he started out in submarines and earned his dolphins, he still wears his dolphins to say, yeah, I was there, I did this, I accomplished something big. And we, in the corporate world, we really haven't figured out how to do that as well as the military has.
As you describe it, I'm thinking, based on your previous experience, that there's a lot of people who might be afraid of singling out employees for that great accomplishment because of the negative backlash, but that's a whole other discussion in itself. Why would they resent people, their heroes being recognized?
Well, we tend to have a negativity bias. It's part of what kept us alive tens of thousands of years ago. It's more important to see the lion or the tiger than to congratulate our colleague on what he or she did. And we have to overcome that, just like we have to overcome the self-centeredness if we're a manager or leader and focus on other people. We have to be very conscious about the fact that recognition is part of the lifeblood of an organization. And what happens when you recognize someone is that they feel an energy, an obligation, a drive towards doing whatever it was you recognized one more time. In the research, the opposite is called behavioral extinction. So if you don't recognize it, then it goes, whatever that behavior was, it goes extinct. You'll hear people say, there's no glory in it, or that's a thankless job, or, don't go there. There's nothing there for you. And if that's how you want your employees thinking about your critical tasks, that they say that's a thankless job, well, then knock yourself out. But it's not a way to help a business survive.
Quick heads up to those listening live. In about a minute and a half, the live portion will come to an end, but all of this will be recorded. We've got a couple more questions, and Rod, if you can stick around for 3-4 more minutes, that'd be great.
Absolutely.
There seems to be a rising backlash to employee engagement. Where do you think that's coming from? You've alluded to it a little bit, but what's the driver for? I see more and more articles, doubting it, being skeptical, criticizing it, poo-pooing it.
Yeah, I think to some degree we've just been whipsawed by the Great Recession. In a lot of cases, I think it's the fact that 2006, 7, early 2008, companies are falling all over themselves in the war for talent. Hey, we want you to have a great job here. And then the recession happens and everything changes. And it's, hey, if you don't like the fact you have to work 55 hours a week and we just laid off your three best friends at work, well, don't let the door hit you in the butt on the way out because I got 50 resumes on my desk of people who want to take your job. And now we're back to, we love you, and we're going to take good care of you, and and we want you to have a great job here. And I think the average employee who went through that says, really? Yeah, okay, fool me once,
yeah.
Shame on you, but Christ, that's shame on me.
Your first book came out in 2006. It's called 12, The Elements of Great Managing. What's the biggest change you've seen over that nine-year period?
Well, the biggest change is the one that I just mentioned. It's the Great Recession, by far. I mean, if you look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics releases a ratio, number of unemployed people per job opening, and that went from 1.5 pre-recession to nearly 7 at the back end of the recession. That's a massive change in the demand for employees. And it's come back down since then to essentially pre-recessionary levels. But just because the number of unemployed people per job opening has gone back to pre-recessionary levels doesn't mean that our psychology has returned. I think to some degree we're a little bit like, oh, I had one grandmother who had gone through the Great Depression. And we'd go to a restaurant, and, you know, Grandma had plenty of money, but if there were rolls left over, she'd put them in her purse. And I said, what are you putting in the, you know, just leave them. She's like, they just have to throw these out anyway, and there's no reason to let good food go to waste. Well, her psychology was, it had been, there was a mark. That depression had left a mark. And
yeah.
I think the same thing, that the Great Recession, even though it's been over for a long time, and jobs numbers are returning, although not pay numbers, it left a mark. And it changes how we view the world. We have not gone back by any means to our pre-recessionary psychological contract.
Yeah, it could be a while. Let's imagine someone standing at your desk waving, and they're mouthing the words, President Obama's on the phone. And sure enough, it turns out to be him, or at least his office. You end up meeting with him in the Oval Office, and he's sitting, you know, behind the great big desk, you know, in that setting we've all seen a million times. And he says to you, Rod, our economy needs some real jobs, some real growth. How do we use this employee engagement thing on a national basis to do that? You know, create some real jobs, drive some real economic growth. What do you tell him?
Well, first, the odds of that happening are quite low, but let's run with the hypothetical. Here's what I'd say. I'd say, Mr. President, you are the leader in a business setting sense and a manager to a whole lot of people, a lot of federal employees who work in the executive branch. So let's focus on you as the leader of an organization. And we'll put aside the citizenry here for a second. I'd say you should apply these concepts to the people that you supervise. And then outside of that, I'd say this is not an issue for the president. If a company doesn't see the wisdom in looking after their people and making sure that understanding that looking out well for those people will have them looking out for the company, then there's really nothing the government can do or needs to do about it. In fact, this truly is one of those situations where the market will correct the problem. The research is really clear. If you don't look out for your people, they'll quit, or your customer service will suffer, or nothing great will be invented there. You'll put yourself at a strategic disadvantage, and companies that do this better will succeed. So this doesn't require, you know, with the exception of laws that have basic protections for, you know, minimum wage and worker safety and all that kind of stuff. This doesn't require any kind of government intervention at all. It requires leaders and managers who understand the reciprocal relationship that they have with their employees and how powerful that reciprocity is.
Excellent. Leaders are readers. Jim Rohn says that. I just quote him. What are you reading these days, you know, fiction or nonfiction?
I have been working through the implications of a book called The Good Jobs Strategy. The author's name is Zainab Khan. She is a professor at MIT, I believe, previously at Harvard. And her argument, I think, is very compelling, is that if you want to look out for your people well, you have to have a really clean, solid operation strategy. We have this national debate going on right now about how can we pay people more, and what can a company afford, and if you pay people too much, does it cut into your profits? Which makes a very compelling argument that the underlying reason why a company could or could not pay people well is ultimately its operation strategy. If you have a Southwest Airlines, which has made money, you know, for 40 plus years straight in a business where the other airlines do not, in many cases, the way that one of the reasons they're able to treat their people well and pay them above market wages is because they fly one kind of airplane, they keep things simple, they cross-train people, and so their operation strategy is so clean that they have the ability to offer low fares to their customers and really good pay to their employees. I think it's important because companies are, in many cases, they're negligent about their people strategy. They'll have their marketing strategy, they'll have their innovation strategy, but they don't think about their people strategy, and they don't think of it holistically. And so that's what I like about Professor Tan's book, The Good Job Strategy, is it begins that process, that interdisciplinary connection that I think we really need to think about if we're going to look out for our people well.
Actually, you know, I just flipped to her page, ZeynepTan.com, and was reading a quick overview of the book, and, wow, that is excellent. You know, with your description and hers, you know, coming up through the ranks, you know, of commoditized services in the telecom industry, you know, our only strategy was engaged employees because we competed in a commodity. And marketing wasn't working. There are 1,000 competitors. And competing on price wasn't going to work. So the only thing we had was we've got to have really great, inspired, maniacal employees and give them the tools to make it happen. And it worked. So
you use the term maniacal, and it's interesting. Jim Collins uses that kind of language relative to big, hairy, audacious goals and things like that. And I'm cool with those kinds of terms as long as there is the maniacal focus on the people. Now, it's a scale. It's like, hey, you look at everything you want in your people and then turn around and say, now, do you have just as much intensity about what you're going to do for your people? And if you do, you're in good shape. If not, it's not going to work.
Yeah, no, I'm completely with you on that one. And the maniacal nature, you know, wasn't this kind of crazy frenzy, but they knew that they could go all out, and we'd give them the resources, we'd make it happen, properly incentivize them for the right, you know, achievements. And if things weren't right, it was an open conversation, and we would work together to figure it out. And if they stumbled and, you know, made a mistake, and everybody did because we were running fast, it was okay. We'd fix it. We'd make it right. We'd make the customer or the colleague right. And then afterwards, we'd add it to the corporate lore of, here's a crazy story. Here's what we learned. So failure is okay. So I'm completely with you on that one. Hey, I have a feeling I could keep on talking with you forever on this book and, you know, our outlooks on employee engagement and share anecdotes and stories, but I'm willing to bet you've got a million things going on with your work with Buy Worldwide. Give us a quick elevator speech on Buy Worldwide, and then tell us where we can find you on the web, and then we got to go.
Well, BI Worldwide is a comprehensive engagement agency. We do everything for organizations from measure them on the new rules to building large employee recognition platforms that help ensure that managers have the tools to recognize employees when they do what the company needs. We set up major company events, and it really just depends on what the needs of the organization is, but we really, our slogan is engage your world. You know, what is it that these employees need, and what is it that the channel needs to make sure that from a behavioral economic standpoint, the company is dialed in properly. Yeah, but for those that are listening, the one thing I would recommend, if you'd like to see how your job rates, is to go to the site widgetsthebook.com and take the free assessment of your job based on the new rules. That was used, it's the same research that was used as the foundation for the book. It's free, there's no catch. It really came down to we needed to build the machinery to field this kind of an instrument for our clients, and it was really no skin off our noses to make it free for individual use on the website. If you go there, you will find out how your job ranks, how you rate your job compared with the rest of the United States. You'll get an actual a number from 1 to 99 as to how well your job is going for you compared to how others' jobs are going for them, and it will tell you where you are of the new rules so that you can understand where to have a conversation with your manager, where things are going great, maybe where to tell your manager thank you. You know, this is I appreciate that you're looking out for me.
Ooh, that's excellent. Ooh, yeah. Yeah, based on Rod's book and all the things I've read, I encourage everyone to go do that. Matter of fact, I'll do that later today. So thanks for reminding me about that. We got to go, Rod. I hate cutting off the conversation because I'm so enjoying it. But I so appreciate you taking the time out, sharing the book, sharing your time here, all the things you write about employee engagement, and you know, good luck. You don't need luck. It looks like you're making it happen every day. But your best wishes for the future. And when you have a new book, let's come back and talk.
Thank you, Zane. Certainly appreciate your time.
Thank you. All right, everybody, we got to go. Go visit Rod at widgetsthebook.com. Follow him on Twitter at Rod_Wagner. And in the meantime, everyone have a great week. Thanks, Rod. Take care.
Thank you.